Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Lessons from the Frontline COVID-19 conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. If you require any further assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Ms. Alina Shakai. Please go ahead, madam.
Thank you, operator, and I will turn things over immediately to Administrator Seema Verma. I'd like to thank all of you for joining our call. Administrator, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Alina, and thank you all for joining us this morning. This is one of our very first call, which is supposed to be a series of calls that we're calling CMS Frontline Learning on COVID-19. We've spoken to many of you before on our other regular stakeholder calls, but this one's going to be a little bit different. We're going to be, you know, in some cases giving you some updates, but the purpose of this call is really to offer a forum for providers around the nation to share with leaders and with one another the innovation that's taking place at the local level around the COVID virus response. I'm going to cut short my comments this morning because Dr. Birx is joining us, and I know she's got to get to another meeting, but she wanted to take a few minutes to address this group, and hopefully she'll be back with us on another day. But Dr. Birx?
Thank you so much, Administrator. I just want to really, again, thank you for setting up this innovation learning call because I think it's really critical. We have been getting reports from the front lines, but more of an anecdotal way, and we think that many of you have developed solutions that are key for our success. And why is this particularly critical? I know all of you are watching New York very carefully. I just want to be very clear that the attack rate normalized for population in the Metro New Jersey, Metro New York City area is about 4 to 5 times any other region in the country, again, normalized for population. So I know you know that they account for 60% of the new cases and 56% of all cases, but only right now, currently 31% of all the new deaths. So if we can learn from you all that have been on the front lines of the previous hotspot, which was out in Washington State, and really make sure that we're carrying your messages as you continue to confront this in a clear way throughout the country and really learning from you all. I think Administrator Verma has been excellent in really staying in communication with you all, and we want to make sure that we're using our federal platform and voice to bring your learnings to scale. So thank you very much, and I just again thank you for what you've done.
Thank you, Dr. Birx. And Dr. Birx had to run to another meeting, but I'm sure she'll join us on another call to be able to give you, different information that's going on. What we want to be able to accomplish on this call, as she said, give you an opportunity to share best practices. We'll also give you updates as we are developing rules, regs, kind of the latest announcements. So that's also an opportunity to get information. I'm also going to have my team on, the CMS team, because we want to hear the challenges that you're facing, and if there's anything that we can do from a regulatory standpoint, we will certainly be attuned to that and adjusting our policies and regulations. I don't want to take up this call in terms of what CMS has planned, but I will tell you that we will have a very significant expansion in waivers and a new rule to give you a lot more flexibility, but that's in the works. It'll probably come out later this week, and we can talk about that when it comes out. The other person that we have on the phone is Dr. Jawa. I'm not sure he's on the line yet. Dr. Jawa, are you with us yet?
Administrator, okay. I believe he'll be in just 2 minutes or so.
Okay, that's fine. We'll just keep going. So when Dr. Jawa joins us, Dr. Jawa is heading up all of our efforts on testing to try to increase testing. We know that that's been a major concern along with supplies, and he can talk a little bit about the supplies as well, but his focus is mostly on testing. But again, today we really want you to be able to have a forum to talk about best practices. And I think today we teed up a few topics. My guess is we won't get through all of them, but patient triage, telehealth, workforce challenges, and then just other topics. And we're really going to count on the group to identify the types of things that you want to spend time on. And also, you know, ask for volunteers. You know, you may have come up with a great strategy that you want to share across the nation and don't have time to write a big journal article or something like that, but this could be a forum for you to share with your peers across the nation some of your best practices. So I think that Dr. Jawad just joined us, and I want to be mindful of his time. We will be rotating the task force members and some of our other leads in different areas to come in and address this group. And so we're very lucky that Dr. Jawad is able to take a few moments of his time to give you an update on the testing situation.
Thank you, Administrator Verma, and thanks for everyone being on the call. As you all know, testing is a rapidly evolving process with new tests coming on the market literally every day, as well as laboratory-derived testing. I would say that there are a couple major issues that have just surfaced. Number one, or opportunities, is number one, the FDA yesterday, after a study we were working with United Health Group and Gates Foundation, approved the use of foam swabs instead of all the fancy flock swabs, or in addition to them, for nasal testing. So that does not mean nasopharyngeal, but a foam swab that could be self-administered nasal instead of the flocked provider. What that does is it opens up a whole nother market of swabs, probably 6 or 7 million. That are on the market now with generally unlimited supply, as well as the ability to do this without changing PPE, because there really is no PPE recommended. I hope that will open up the front side of the equation. On the back side of the equation, as you know, Roche, Abbott, Qiagen, Thermo Fisher all have tests on the market. Depending on what laboratory you have, there is now a point of care test from Cepheid, of which 60,000 cartridges will come out. This is going to be very important to many of your hospitals, and we need to get input on who has machines, who needs machines, but this is a 45-minute turnaround, relatively low throughput, depending on the number of machines, but is going to be critical, as we think it, for hospital testing, for infection control, and for diagnosis, as well as for nursing homes. But my team is ready to field questions and to answer questions as you need it, and I'll be on the call to understand what you need as we go on. Thank you, Fema. Thank you, Fema.
Dr. Jawad, why don't we open the line to ask a few questions, and then that way we can move on to a different topic, and I know you've got a lot of pressing issues to deal with, so why don't we just open the line, and if people have specific questions for you, why don't we can go ahead and get those addressed.
Operator, would you please open the lines for Q&A?
Thank you. Just a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. Again, to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster.
While we're waiting, I will also say that we formally put out and are communicating priorities for testing. And several of the major reference labs are acting on that. I need to get a daily update. I know LabCorp did it yesterday, so that hospitalized patients will be given a separate code to have priority. What we don't want is the low-risk people who are getting tested from all over the country in a variety of situations to dilute and to put back in line the people who are in the hospital or ICUs if you're using the central services. So I just wanted to make that while we're waiting for questions.
Operator, do we have any questions?
A person on queue, please state your first and last name. Your line is open. I'm sorry, that is Pamela Hoffman.
Hi, I have a question about telemedicine, so I can wait.
Thank you. Well, and bear with us. I think we have about 5,000 people on the line today, so it's a lot to manage. If people have particular questions on testing, if operator, you're able to open the line. Otherwise, we'll move on with the rest of the agenda.
Thank you. Next question comes from the line of Laurie Whiteman. Your line is open.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Dr. Philip Fraseca. We have been notified about the availability of a 15-minute turnaround IgM, IgG rapid test that's an antibody rather than a nucleic acid testing. Is that something any of you are aware of and know if that is available for clinical use?
This is Brett Giroir. I am not aware of that, and the FDA, as of last night, is not aware of it. But remember, in the milieu you have, some states have basically the regulatory authority of the FDA, and these tests could be out there if they're notified to the states. But according to the FDA, there is not a notification to them about this test in queue for an EUA, and there's not an EUA. If you have any specifics about what the test is in the manufacturer, please send it to me. What is it? And I will track it down and get a general.
What is your email?
Well, everybody knows it. Brett.giroir@hhs.gov. Brett.giroir@hhs.gov.
All right. Thank you.
Let me also say that the FDA, it's on there. If you do FDA coronavirus FAQs, there is a 24/7 hotline that you can call them at any time to answer that kind of question. We set that up about a week and a half ago, and if they don't know it, it goes right to Jeff Shuren. So we wanted to make that available for these types of things, as well as substitutable reagents, et cetera.
Next question comes from the line of Amy Davis. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Dr. Davis. Thanks for taking the time to do this. Do you know if there's a difference in specificity and sensitivity with the new swabs?
We're based on very limited data, right? So this was the data was supplied to the FDA. This was a study done on 600 suspected patients with four match swabs, tongue, self-administered nasal, self-administered mid-turbinate, and a classic nasopharyngeal flock swab. And essentially, it was the mid-turbinate, the nasal self, and the nasopharyngeal. I haven't reviewed all the data, but according to Jeff Shuren, we're nearly identical. The tongue swab and oral is much less sensitive. So based on that, the FDA put out that it's substitutable. So and again, we're dealing with limited. That's a number of 600 with about, I think it was 36 positives in that. But that's what we have. And so we're not seeing a loss in sensitivity. Now, based on the Seattle flu study, which is a Gates Seattle flu study that they've been doing self-swabbing for 29 other viruses for the past few years, the self-swab nasal is really identical and to the nasopharyngeal. We just didn't know it for COVID-19, and it was important because it has a predilection for the lower respiratory tract. Let me also say that the CT number was also taken. So, you know, the cycle number on the thermocycler to understand how many amplifications you need, and it was nearly identical for nasal as well as nasopharyngeal. The oral buccal was much higher, and therefore it's still not recommended. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much.
Next question comes from the line of Bettina Riveros. Your line is open.
Thank you. Bettina Riveros, Christiana Care in Delaware. We've been working. You mentioned the Roche and CFID, the point of care test. Who's the best contact on that? We've been working to try to get reagent for our Roche 6800. Any further information on how we can connect on that, or if there's an alternative that would work for us? It would be great to have a contact point. Thanks.
I think the Roche reagents are really in short supply. This is their large high throughput system, right? The 6800. Is that right?
Yes, my understanding.
They only have 400,000 tests available. We are not directing them in any way except. They told us they were shipping to the biggest hotspots until they can up their production, meaning New York, Washington, and some of the reference laboratories. So I don't have a handle on that. on the Cepheid, do you have the platform itself?
We would have to confirm that. We have the Roche 6800 machine.
Yeah, but they're totally different. I mean, the Cepheid machine, you're really only going to be doing their highest throughput is 64 samples at a time, and most machines are 4 to 8. So this is a whole different ConOps. But it could be very useful, like in an ICU, if you need to know a diagnosis, or you're in a nursing home. So it's a whole different, a whole different platform. So Roche, I don't have an answer because Roche has very limited supply. They're supposed to be ramping up their supply, but again, it's only at about the 400,000 test level per week, and that is not enough to supply all the labs.
We do have the Cepheid machine, so if we could get a contact for that, that would be really helpful.
Okay, we can supply. So Cepheid is going to be doing their supply through their normal. This is sort of in real time here, but through their normal channels, we are going to work with them to make sure that the U.S. domestic market is supplied. But we don't intend to. Our intent right now is not to interfere with their supply chains, but to let them answer the orders that they're getting from throughout the United States as long as the hotspots are covered. So it's from their normal Cepheid supply. And again, they only have 60,000 tests this week. So that's not going to be enough to go around the country, but it should be used for those really priority patients where you need to know in 45 minutes. We certainly don't want people to use this on a worried well or other people. It's really for actionable data that you need in the first hour.
I appreciate it. We've been trying through the supply chain. What they've told us is they ship to Italy. So thanks.
That Cepheid ships to Italy?
That's what our supply chain was told by them.
So our intent is to make sure that that doesn't happen. And again, this is in real time, but with the Defense Production Act, we have the ability to assure that it gets domestically to high points. And by the end of the day, we will have that worked out. We want to be fair to around the world, but this is our only point of care diagnostic. And, it's the administration's intention to keep that domestically until
Thanks.
There are more supplies.
Next question comes from the line of Mike Wargo. Your line is open.
Good morning, Admiral Giroir. This is John Perlin, HCA Healthcare. First, let me thank you so very much for your exceptional leadership and the hard work in the important area of lab testing. This may be more of a comment because it was alluded to between the times that the operator opened the line, but I just want to emphasize the importance of prioritizing the lab testing for the in-hospital patients. It's not only important in terms of getting the answer, but we have 30 patients in some markets for every COVID-positive patient for PUI, and very difficult to provide disposition for because post-acute care won't take patients absent a negative COVID test. We can argue about the merits of that, but the most expeditious route for patients who've been languishing up to a week would be to accelerate and prioritize the testing. The other point I'm sure obvious to the team is that those PUI patients burn the same amount of PPE as a COVID positive until they're rolled out. So anything you can do to prioritize the testing in all means is much appreciated. Thanks so much again.
So thanks, John. If you have any ideas, from my standpoint, obviously your in-hospital tests are going to prioritize who you prioritize. What I've asked the ACLA labs is to follow the prioritization that we put out as official guidance yesterday. I know LabCorp is doing it now with a separate code for hospitalized patients that they go to the front of the line at their testing facilities. I will check with ACLA, but if you have any other strategy, please let me know. We're certainly going to prioritize point-of-care tests to, hospital systems as opposed to drive-throughs for the worried well. If you have any other ideas, I could do it on the backside with ACLA. I assume you're doing it in your hospital. Just let me know and we'll do it.
Will do. Thank you very much. Preserve the.
Next question comes from the line of Derek Greenwald. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is actually Gerald Cate, and I'm in the laboratory. I see a lot of concern about the NP swabs. I'll be honest with you, our biggest problem is the viral transport media. We run these molecular tests, and while we have the swab, you can't typically go from swab to instrument. They have to be pipetted, so we have to have some type of matrix. So without that viral transport media, our respiratory pathogen panels and our COVID testing is still limited for big hospitals or small hospitals, both.
Okay, so
we're allocated five a week.
So please go to the FDA FAQs. The FDA has approved sterile saline as a transport media, so that should eliminate that problem. We just need to get that information out there. There are a couple alternatives aside from VTM, so that should. Sure. I don't know the data on that. The FDA says it's an acceptable alternative, so I would suggest
it has to be validated. Right now, the only lab is LabCorp that accepts that. So Quest right now is not accepting saline. If you go through them. They may have changed, but they still want to do their own validations. So LabCorp is done, and we just got an email this weekend that they're taking frozen saline. So, and that is helpful on the COVID side.
Okay, that's good information. I know what the FDA has said is acceptable. I do not have the detail down to the reference lab of what they're taking, and I will take that as an action item to see if we can get some systematic work on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jawan. I want to be mindful of your time. We will be having these calls regularly, and so we can bring Dr. Jawan back, and we could also bring somebody from the FDA to answer questions as well. Appreciate all the great information here, Dr. Jawan, and your time today. Let's switch gears, and I think one of the other topics that we thought we could focus on today, given all of the work and all of the flexibility that we're doing around telehealth, not just in Medicare, but across the insurance industry, some of the flexibility that we've provided around HIPAA to allow physicians to use Skype and FaceTime and things like that, I think hopefully has helped. Also in Medicare, we're waiving copays, and I believe that a lot of the commercial insurance plans have done that as well. And so, you know, what I thought would be helpful today is just hear from those on the front lines. I believe that we have Dr. Allison Haddock on the line. She is Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at Baylor College in Texas. Dr. Haddock, are you on the line? Did you want to make a few comments about some of how you've been using telehealth?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for introducing me. I'm a member of the Board of Directors at the American College of Emergency Physicians, and in that role, I'm helping support our members around the country who are involved in telehealth. And I can really say that we're seeing emergency departments around the country adopting telehealth that have never used it before. On my shift last night, for example, I used an iPad to reassess a patient, and this is the first time that I've ever done that in my emergency department. Doing that allowed me to preserve PPE while reducing staff exposure to the patient, but still allowed me to provide a high quality of care to him by visually reevaluating him and answering all of his questions. That's a great example of something that your new regulations have allowed us to do. Another place that we're seeing increased use of help is at point of entry into the emergency department, and we're developing an app that's almost ready to roll out to help triage our patients into the separate waiting room for patients with potential COVID symptoms versus those without those symptoms. But our members around the country are still asking for a little bit more guidance around telehealth, particularly at the point of entry, in order to know whether telehealth can be used to satisfy the MSE under EMTALA. They also have some questions about the ability to use our usual emergency medicine E&M codes for care that's delivered by emergency physicians for an emergency complaint via telehealth. And adding those to the approved Medicare codes would better reflect the intensity of the services that we're providing. We appreciate what's been done so far, including the guidance that was given during the Ebola outbreak. But we do need a little bit of additional guidance to help us expand the use of this modality in order to preserve PPE and preserve our healthcare workforce while still providing excellent care. The College of Emergency Physicians is accepting stories from our members and is really happy to continue this dialogue with you and share examples of how we're using telehealth. And I thank you again for the opportunity to join this call.
Thank you. And you will be seeing more from CMS. I think we recognize that there could be more done on telehealth Also within Medicare, there's a lot of requirements, as you all know, about face-to-face requirements, which we are looking to address, as well as specifically giving more flexibilities to emergency rooms to use more telehealth. So we're in the process on that and appreciate your detailed comments. But I think we should, you know, fingers crossed, we'll get something out in the next few days here. So appreciate that. Also, I think we have Dr. Peter Holman from Rhode Island, who's also a member of the AMA. Dr. Holman, do you want to talk about how you're using telehealth?
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And again, I'd like to also echo the thanks for the site of service waiver and the HIPAA requirements. In Rhode Island, this has been the silver lining, if there is one, to this problem that we're all facing. We're bringing telehealth to every practice. It's helped us take care of our patients and help keep the practices open and running. There are several things that we're doing in Rhode Island which may be different, and other states may be doing the same. We have a health insurance commissioner, and the commissioners was very concerned, as were many of the payers and the practices as well, about making sure we can get care to everybody who doesn't have access to the real-time audio-video type of formats, and also to deliver both primary care and mental health services. So we have a regulation that took effect this past week that requires all services that can be delivered in person, that if they can be appropriately be provided by real-time audio, video, or by audio alone, in other words, just a telephone call, those services must be covered by the payers, and they must be covered at the full amount that we'd be covered for a participating payer if they were done in person. Some of the plans have also waived co-pays for those types of services. That's not uniform. That has been extremely helpful. There are many questions when such a rule is implemented, and so one of the things that is extremely helpful is to have consistency in policy, things such as which modifiers to use, what are some of the rules. Questions have come to me, especially as was already mentioned, about the documentation guidelines, the CPT definitions, when for certain services there is a very limited exam component. So we are writing that. The AMA is putting out coding guidance as well over COVID, and I'm trying to help both locally and with the AMA on that. I think it's important to recognize the way Medicare sets a standard for everybody, and I think that once the leadership is shown there, which it has been, it helps everybody sort of fall in line to get consistency, and it's very important that the Medicare Advantage plans follow all the requirements that CMS has set for the traditional Medicare fee-for-service. As you heard from the emergency room physician, it is important that these services be available in all settings. You know, as a primary care geriatrician, I would not have necessarily been aware of this, but because of my role in my multi-specialty group, which does hospital care and critical care, I realized that due to the shortage of personal protective equipment, we have people in the hospitals and in nursing homes that are also providing services by telemedicine. That is the safest way that they can provide patient cares both to their health, but also to the health of the other patients in the facility. And rules such as requirements that skilled nursing facility can only have telehealth services once every 30 days and they cannot be used for the mandatory visits are the type of detailed thing that does need to be looked at, and we know that CMS will be evaluating these types of issues as well. So we're very thankful for this. We're looking forward to working through all the problems and getting the details resolved. So that we are able to deliver this service to everybody. And I think the first most important step is to include telephone or audio-only services.
Well, Dr. Holman, we hear you. I think both of those issues, the nursing home limitations, I think our first step was just to get the telehealth out there as sort of more a part of the emergency declaration, knowing that we needed something ASAP. But we're in the process of kind of going through a lot of those, what I'd call additional barriers in the Medicare program, 30 days, telephone calls, all of those things are being looked at. Unfortunately, those require us to go through rulemaking, but our team's been working around the clock, and you all should see something pretty shortly on that, but I appreciate you raising the issue. I think we also have Dr. Harmon, who is a family physician who's implementing telehealth. And again, if you can just tell us a little bit more about how you're approaching it, you know, in your office, it may be helpful for your peers. Thank you. Do we have Dr. Harmon on the line? Okay, well, maybe not. So maybe we'll try to hear from Dr. Harmon. Any other, just before we switch topics here, is there anybody else that would want to say a few words about telehealth, any best practices or techniques that they're using that are useful that your peers may want to hear about?
Operator, can we please open the line to the audience? Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone. First is Norton Ellison. Your line is open.
Hi. I'm from Adventist Healthcare, and we're concerned about our older healthcare workers. Is there any recommendation or guideline regarding healthcare workers or who are aged, over 70, or have other conditions which would predispose to COVID or COVID complications?
Sure. I would refer you to the CDC website. I think what we're this segment of the conversation is about telehealth. So if people have suggestions on telehealth, best practices, I think we'd want to focus on those questions. But my counsel to you would be to go to the CDC website.
Thank you.
Do we have
Thank
any
you.
More comments? Go ahead.
Operator, do we have any more comments on best practices around telehealth? Thank you.
There are no few at this time. Presenters, please continue.
Okay, the next area that we wanted to at least spend a little bit of time on was workforce challenges. The last question was sort of along those lines is, what workforce challenges are causing the most strain? What strategies have you been using to help address these challenges? I think we've heard some facilities or hospitals establishing new or existing programs on childcare or meals. Anything that people want to speak to, I think we can open the line on that. And Dr. Mark Victor, who's a cardiologist from Philly, if you're on the line, I heard you may have some suggestions.
Yes, thank you again for the opportunity, Administrator Verma. Just to answer the last point, I did try to signal in, but I couldn't, about telehealth, because I think they really both go hand in glove. So our practice is a cardiology practice, and I'm on this call on behalf of the American College of Cardiology. We, on Monday the 16th, our practice, which is a fairly large practice throughout the five counties of Greater Philadelphia Metroplex, we went to a virtual telehealth relationship. We had all of our employees, all 450 non-provider employees, working from home. We initiated as of Monday morning when we began that each visit would be as parallel to a regular in-face office visit as we could. So we had our medical assistant and our front desk people call the patient, tell them that they're about to have their visit, why we shifted from offices after notifying virtually all of them by phone over the course of the weekend. And then just as our workflow would have been in the office, the medical assistant would call the patient, go over their list of symptoms, go over their active medications, any new problems that have occurred, lab work, if it was available, scanned into the system, and then said that the physician will call them back within 5 to 10 minutes. And indeed, when I would then call the patient and my colleagues, we would entertain a full host of the same questions, the same areas of specificity of that particular patient's problems that we would have in the office. If they had a scale or a blood pressure cuff, we would have them take it at that time, review lab work, change medications if necessary, and that was our telehealth visit. We found that the video component, especially in older patients and some of our inner city patients, became more of a confusing delay in care and became sort of, in some cases, a circus. Patients not wanting to be seen, they weren't dressed appropriately, embarrassed by their lack of aptitude, and we found it more of a hindrance than a help. We also created 6 triage centers out of our 35 offices that were regional. We said that those offices would be properly staffed with physicians and staff that were protected. We would screen the patients before they entered the triage office with their temperature and questions. And what we found was, expecting those triage offices to be quite brisk in volume, we found that the amount of patients that had to actually be seen over these last 8 days was surprisingly low for a cardiology practice that typically sees huge numbers of patients. And we've shrunk those from 6 to 3, and today we only have one open, seeing about a dozen patients. As it relates to the employees, needless to say, we had to convert a lot of employees. About 75 of our employees were involved in advanced imaging, and since we've canceled all advanced imaging, we've preserved their incomes but shifted them to this type of call, triage, outreach, telehealth, to prepare the patients both for the next visit and beyond. How long we're going to be able to maintain that, of course, is questionable, but so far we've made that commitment to our entire workforce, all of whom continue to work from home. I hope that answers some questions, and I'll be happy to answer any further if I can be of help.
I'm just going to pause there for a second. That was a great overview. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Victor?
Operator, can we please open up the line for questions? Thank you.
As a reminder, to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone, person on queue. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open. For the person who queued in for a question, your line is open.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Vanderpool. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm at the University of Tennessee, a university anesthesiologist. We own a pain medicine practice. And our challenge has been, I'm curious about converting non-medical assistant employees to be able to still help the practice produce revenue during this challenging time. I'd like to hear more about your call tree, how you're repurposing some of your other employees, and what type of hours they're able to capture with the different types of phone calls, and what types of phone call questions they're asking the patients, so that you can keep the practice running, generate revenue, but appropriately compensate your employees for the value they're bringing.
So we have not utilized anybody but our provider staff, which is physicians and APPs, to actually be the forward-facing team to patient care. But we've used all of the non-provider workforce to prepare those patients for the calls, to get all the reference data, which, you know, used to be streams and streams of it by faxes to the office, and now we're doing it in an electronic care medium. We do have some of our provider support staff working non-traditional hours because of the children at home. And so we have found that forward-reaching the patients for visits tomorrow, the next day, many times, because they're also in a home environment, some are homeschooling, some are taking walks with their kids outside, they're not as available as traditionally they should or would have been. So off-hours phone calls has actually been a key strategy to engaging a larger percentage of patients to be prepared for their next day visit. So, yes, we have definitely used non-traditional time, but we have not used any non-provider as an actual provider of telehealth care. I hope that answers that question.
It does. Thank you very much.
Next question comes from the line of Gregory Esther. Your line is open.
Hello, my name is Dr. Gregory Esper. I'm the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Emory Healthcare, and this is a question for the presenting physician, and I also have some best practices from telehealth from our perspective that we could share if there is time. The question that I have for the presenters, especially cardiology, is for your patients that you are delivering care at home but are still requiring a cardiac exam, and that would potentially include new patients. Have you deployed any technology to their home or have advised them on any technology so that you could potentially examine the heart electronically, the heart and lungs, to be able to document the cardiovascular and pulmonary exam? That's the first question.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, crucial clearly to our field, and each member on this call has their own fields where certain key elements of the exam are crucial. So for new patients, obviously, we've had people referred for new heart murmur, new rhythm or palpitation disturbance. So those are exactly the kinds of patients that would be then re-referred from the screening telehealth cardiologist to one of these triage centers that I alluded to, where they would actually be seen in person by one of the team. We've been working with a number of telehealth companies, and we actually have a project we're working with Philips to do exactly what you've suggested, but it is not yet online, and we don't have it as a part of this outreach. And we were in the early phases of rolling it out, so it's sadly about this crisis is a few months too early for our particular level of expertise, but many perhaps on this call have already deployed those physiologic tools to enable further outreach. We do find, however, and I talked to one of my primary care colleagues the other day about this, sending a patient for a new heart murmur, while really important, I still believe that the crucial elements of the decision tree of whether that patient's murmur is going to be relevant for an immediate care decision can mostly be handled by history, because even if their mitral regurgitation is moderate or severe by exam and echo, the crucial area of the decision tree is, are they symptomatic? Are they short of breath? Are they having trouble laying flat? Are they having palpitations? Do they have edema? And so by going through those things, I believe we've still been able to give appropriate triage. While we still have to answer that question, is it moderate or severe MR? I think we can still outline a care path for that patient at this moment.
Thank you. That's a very helpful answer. May I ask some questions of the CMS team while I have the comm?
Sure, go ahead.
Specifically for the critical care billing codes, the 99291 and the 99292, as well as the emergency medicine billing codes, are those being updated for use in telehealth?
Yes, you're going to see some more guidance on the codes probably later this week on that particular. We understand that there's been a lot of questions on that, so expect to see something just in the next few days here.
Thank you. We saw some a potential need for physicians to update their site of service on their Medicare profile to add their home site as a site of service. Is that a standard that we should be asking our physicians to do? And if so, can that be waived?
Okay, I will look into that. I agree the timing's not great on that, so let me look into that. I appreciate you raising the issue.
The last question I have is, our APPs are in the state of Georgia, where Emory is, our APPs are required to update their supervision to reflect the fact that they can practice by telemedicine. While that may be a state requirement, is there a federal requirement for them to do that? And if so, can that be waived so that we don't have to do a lot of paperwork with the thousand or so APPs that we have before they can deliver telehealth services?
Yeah, I can't control what goes on at the state level, but I couldn't agree with you more. The last thing we want to do right now is add more paperwork to what you already have on your plate. So I will look into that and ensure that there are no additional requirements on that at this time.
And we do have some best practices that I could share for others
if we have time.
Okay. We actually, because we had to roll out telehealth to basically thousands of providers, including physicians and APPs, we actually developed a three-part HealthStream Learning Center module, after which we required a test and an attestation that would allow the providers to then be certified to produce telehealth visits under their privileging and credentialing that already exists. So we'd be happy to share the module that we developed for that. We've created also a GME policy and workflows for residents and fellows to participate in telemedicine services, provided that the right staffing is in place for them to deliver those services for their learning, as opposed to for a service perspective. We'd be happy to share that policy for those of you that have residents and fellows. We've created a hub and spoke model at our health system that allows the disparate parts of our organizations to have facilitators that directly align with our small central telehealth team, by which we update our standard work hourly and daily, and then we present that work to a SharePoint site that is available for all members of the provider community to look at. And so they can actually see what are the best practices, not only for providers, but also what is patient education to be able to deliver to patients how to get on a telehealth site or on a telehealth visit, as well as advice and standard work for schedulers to book those visits as well. And we are primarily using the Zoom platform. We've created extensive education that we're happy to share with people that wish to have that. We are deploying inpatient models for PPE preservation, for audiovisual consultation for patients at end of life whose family cannot be present in the ICU for consultation. We are actively involved in assessing digital strategies for testing and delivery of testing with some organizations. So we're happy to share information, and I can give my email if people are interested in having that, and we can if I'm allowed to do that from the CMS side.
Oh, please do. I think it's just a great example of the types of learnings that we want to get out there. So if you want to give your email address, and we can also follow up and make sure it's posted somewhere. But go ahead. Thank you.
My name is Gregory Esper, ESP as in Peter, ER. My email address is ESP as in Peter, ER, at Emory, Emory.edu. That's gesper@emory.edu. We'll be happy to share any information that we have to make it easier for other folks.
Okay.
Thank you.
That was terrific. And so I also want to switch gears, and we didn't get a chance to talk about triage. We've heard that that's a major issue for providers that are on the front lines. And so I think today we have Dr. Gene Kuttner, from the Chief Medical Officer at the University of Colorado, to talk about triage for patients during COVID. Dr. Kuttner?
Dr. Kuttner, do we have you on mute?
And if Dr. Kuttner's not there, I think there's also Dr. Christine Carr.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for listening. I'm an emergency physician in South Carolina. I work at a large academic medical center, and we are doing a lot of the telehealth already. We are moving to iPads, and specifically we're trying to do triage prior to patients entering the emergency departments, and I think I speak for a lot of EDs across the country. EMTALA, to date, mandates that we do our medical screening exam. We would like to use telehealth or even iPads to use providers that may be in a different location or could even be inside of the ED, but do a medical screening exam and redirect patients if they don't have a medical emergency to alternative care sites, i.e. not the emergency department. And we would like clarification on, is that okay to do a telehealth visit only as a medical screening exam for EDs?
That's something that we've heard a lot about, and that's going to be part of the guidance that hopefully we'll be able to get out in the next few days on that. And I think we agree that that would be a tool that we would want ERs to be able to use.
Thank you.
So any other, we've just got a few minutes here. Are there any other, does anybody else want to comment on triage in hospital settings?
Hey, Dr. Verma, this is our Administrator Verma. This is Jerry Harmon with the AMA and a physician, a family medicine specialist in South Carolina, in rural South Carolina. We are triaging and keeping folks out of our emergency departments and even out of our practices by having folks call ahead rather than showing up in our family medicine offices. And then we actually have outside tents set up with adverse weather gear. We have PPE on our screeners who are actually screening the patients in the parking lot before we let them into our facility. And we've had an incredible impact on reducing the ER overcrowding here in South Carolina.
That's terrific.
Dr. Carr is at the Medical University and Academic Medical Center down in Charleston, about an hour and a half south, and with in conjunction as an affiliate with her institution, we're getting referrals who are checking online in, giving their symptoms, and then if their qualifications are for appropriate screening, we're seeing them in the local area, and we're doing it really at no charge to the patients, so I think the physicians are stepping up incredibly there.
That's great to hear. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to open up the line. Does anybody have any other questions for the speakers?
Again, to ask
operator,
a question,
please open the line.
You may press star 1 on your telephone. Our first question comes from the line of Michelle Prentice. Your line's open.
Hi there, Michelle Prentice. I'm a family medicine resident in my third year with the Medical College of Wisconsin. And my question is kind of surrounding capacity planning for some of the residents. As you may know, for example, our board certification exams have been canceled in some cases. And also some of our rotations have been canceled. I can give an example of myself. I was supposed to be on infectious disease next month. But I'm just wondering, this is kind of an open question for everybody, where you see us fitting in. I know there's a shortage of protective equipment, but there's a number of new roles that I think we could, you know, participate in. Just want to hear from people where you see us best fitting in this time.
Administrator Verma, this is Dr. Orlowski. I'd like to address the question.
Sure, please.
Sure. Hi, this is Janice Orlowski. I'm the Chief Healthcare Officer at the Association of American Medical Colleges, and we thank you very much for your comments. We see residents as a critical part of the workforce here as we continue to plan. In regards to your own individual situation, we do know that some elective rotations have been canceled, but we know that academic medical centers are planning to utilize residents in specific capacities throughout their institution. Also, if you take a look at the ACGME website, they are providing information to you regarding any issues regarding supervision, any issues regarding your concerns of whether you will graduate on time and what the role of residents are. We continue to work with the ACGME and the academic medical centers to make all of our healthcare workers participate at the appropriate level. And I'd be happy if you had a specific issue to give me an email. My email address is jorlowski, J-O-R-L-O-W-S-K-I, @aamc.org, jorlowski@aamc.org. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next question comes from the line of Marcus Luz. Your line is open.
Hi, I want to thank you for having this call. My name is Marcus Luz. I apologize. I'm the CEO of a small rural hospital and a rural health clinic in North Dakota. And the telehealth, while we're very excited about it, there are certain rules on rural health clinic that are still restricting some of those options. And we're hoping that those will be relaxed to fill some of those needs. And then also on the triage, I do want to say that the critical access hospital, we've really appreciated the different and unique ideas, I guess, through a rural lens on this, completing those kind of triage, and we've able to do it. We just really would like to expand it to our clinic and hopefully recapture some of those lost volumes in this uncertain time.
And I'll just answer that one really quickly. We have identified that there are some barriers for FQHCs and rural health clinics. I believe that there is legislation moving on that to address it. I think CMS had some restraints within our authority, but fingers crossed that this bill passes. But I do believe there is language in there to address that.
Well, thank you so much. It really would make a huge difference to our population.
Thank you. And I want to make sure we're mindful of everybody's time today. You know, these are trying times for all of us, and those of you that are on the front lines really are the heroes of this fight, of this war. And I can tell you from CMS's perspective, the entire federal agency, and from the president himself, you know, we want to do everything that we can to support you. From CMS's perspective, we're trying to get all of these regulations out of the way that we know are interfering with your ability to provide care during the pandemic. So you're going to see a lot more from us on this. These calls really are intended, again, to answer your questions. We just want to make sure that we're keeping the dialogue going between us and you, but also between the providers. You know, just the conversation that we had today, you being able to share what you're doing, everybody's trying to figure out the same issues, solve the same problems on the local level, and to the extent that we can work together and share best practices, I think it'll help all of us. So we're going to continue to have these calls. I will invite folks in. Give us your suggestions on what topics you'd like us to cover. If you have something that you want to present, we're happy to give you some time to do that. And again, let us know what your questions are. We can bring in additional speakers. You know, whether it's the FDA, I think Dr. Birks would like to come back as well. She can give you a little sense of the data that she's seeing and her analysis, and we can bring others as well. So, again, just thank you all for what you're doing. We know that, you know, you all are on the front lines of this, and we're here to support you and just appreciate everything that you're doing for all of America, for your patients, and for this fight. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks indeed, Administrator Vermeer. Honored to do it.
Thank you very much, Administrator.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.